Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to That UFO Podcast. As always, my name is Andy, and today I am joined by John Priestland and Dr. Martin Abbas from Unhidden, a UK-based medically-led organisation looking at one of the most overlooked parts of the UAP conversation. Not the craft, not the secret programmes, not even the politics, but the people. If disclosure ever really happens, whether that's in the coming months, years from now, or not at all, there is still a serious question to ask. How would society cope with the information that fundamentally changes our understanding of reality? Would the public be prepared? Would doctors, therapists, and mental health professionals know how to respond? Would governments and health systems have any kind of plan for the psychological and social impact? Their new report, Preparing for Disclosure, looks exactly at that. It asks whether a paradigm-shifting event around UAP or non-human intelligence should be treated not just as political or scientific issue, but potentially as a public health preparedness issue too. This is a different kind of video. It's not about chasing the latest videos, arguing over file drops, or asking who knows what behind closed doors. Trust me, those are all still to come in the coming weeks. It's about ordinary people and what happens if the world suddenly has to deal with something it can't easily explain. So with all that said, let's get into the conversation with John Priestland and Dr. Martin Abbas from Unhidden. I am now joined on the podcast by John Priestland and Dr. Martin Abbas from Unhidden. That Unhidden is a medically led organisation, folks, looking at one of the most overlooked parts of the UAP conversation. And it's not the craft, it's not the programmes, it's not the politics, but it's the people. And it's a UK-based organisation, which is obviously close to my heart. And their new report, Preparing for Disclosure, asks what happens if society is confronted with information that genuinely changes how we understand reality and whether governments, health systems and communities are remotely prepared for the psychological and social impact. So welcome to both of you.
Hello, Andy. Thanks for having us.
Hi, Andy. Thank you for having us.
Great to have you both on. What I'm going to ask you to do very briefly, we'll start with you, John, is if you could just give us the kind of the quick notes version of who you are and a little bit of your background, please.
Very much so. So I'm John Priestland. I'm a physicist by origin, a management consultant by day, founder and chairman of Unhidden by night. Relevant too to my background is I was at the Cabinet Office in the 90s. I wrote two white papers and hopefully bring some of that to what we're doing with the Unhidden reports.
Wonderful. And Martin?
Hi and hello audience. I'm Dr. Martin Abbas, a Yorkshire lad that came to London and studied medicine. I've been a doctor for 3 decades, GP for 2 decades, and I got involved with sort of UFO research or UAP research, as it were, for about 16 years now, and with Unhidden over the last year or so. So it's been an eventful life so far, and this is becoming increasingly interesting.
Wonderful. And John, how far back, because we've met in person a couple of times now, John, haven't we? Very briefly on one occasion, a little bit longer on another, a couple of different events, but it's good to have you finally on the podcast and very timely. Your UFO interest, how far back does it go?
About 4 years. I'm a physicist, as I say, brought up to believe the things good physicists believe. So we believe in Newton's laws of motion, quantum mechanics, Maxwell's equations, or some of them. And we don't believe in ley lines, astrology, crystal theory, and UFOs. And it was my brother-in-law came round about 4 years ago and said, hey, John, you need to look at these videos, presumably things like James Fox's phenomenon. These UFOs, they're buzzing these nuclear facilities. And that was the point at which I started to take a look, and down the rabbit hole I've come.
Wonderful. And what about yourself, Doc Martin, as we have it?
The initial time that sort of John probably heard about me, I was sort of working with an experiencer called Paul Sinclair. And I was looking at the sort of the health effects that were happening to him. And fortuitously, John was looking at the psychological effects, and there was a paper written for that. And then obviously the physical effects, and I was sort of involved a little bit with the physical effects paper. And then obviously the natural progression has been the sort of the public health paper that's been written that I've been involved in as well. So it's very much sort of, instead of it being sort of the sort of general review that you have of UAP and is it real, is it not real, this has become very much in my wheelhouse, the sort of the medical effect. So that's really sort of piqued my interest. And it's certainly a space that's lacking for the medical profession. So, yeah, this is.
Did you have an interest outside of that professionally going back or?
Yeah, absolutely. For the last 16 years, I've been sort of interested in the phenomenon. And I sort of go to the cliffs of Yorkshire with my friend Paul and his team. And we sort of look at the skies for 4 or 5 hours a night and looking at these unusual phenomenon flying around in right angle turns at speed. It's very unusual. So, you know, there's something going on. I don't know what it is. It could be all military, of course, but whatever it is, it's unusual and hence it's interesting.
Yeah, and if folks are wondering, Paul Sinclair has been on the podcast a few times, author of the Truth Proof series, wonderful researcher based here in the UK. He's got his own YouTube live stream that happens a couple of times a week as well. So folks, if you're not familiar, go and check out those interviews. There's some fascinating conversations and deep dives into various UK-based cases. But keeping it in the UK then for now, let's go back to John. John, tell us a little bit about Unhidden as an organisation. When did that begin and why did it begin?
So let's go back to summer 2023. My exploration of the link between UFOs and nuclear facilities, which is what my brother-in-law said, look at these videos, look at the connection. As a good physicist, that shouldn't be, because if the UFOs are ball lightning, Chinese lanterns, the planet Venus, swamp gas, etc., how do they know where the nuclear facilities are? That sounds like intelligent control. So that challenged, as we might say, my worldview. I had a little touch of ontological shock. But the thing that really affected me was I couldn't find anybody to talk to me. They all laughed at me. They said, John, you've gone a bit funny. You've gone a bit conspiracy theory. Go away and leave me alone. So I had six lonely months where I thought about this a lot and I just wanted to talk to someone. And so Unhidden was set up with the simple proposition that we should encourage better conversations around UAPs. And that's good for people's mental health. I work in the construction sector, and there's a wonderful charity that I was really positive about called Mates in Mind. We have a great record now on avoiding accidents on construction sites, but we have 4 times the level of suicides in the construction sector. Why? Because we have tough blokes, and it's largely blokes, working away from home. And there is a stigma about talking about depression and talking about mental health. So Mates in Mind encourages better conversations that allow people to get out their problems and share them with their colleagues at work. And Unhidden is built on the same principle. Our mental health and our well-being is going to be stronger if we push back stigma, we push back shame, and we can start to talk about something which we should be able to talk about just like everything else. Nothing special about UAPs. Let's have an open, honest, data-based and compassionate conversation. That's the foundation of Unhidden.
And Martin, I was asking you just before we hit record. Now, I can't ask you to breach patient confidentiality and go into details and specifics, but how often does a conversation arise, whether it's with yourself or potentially you've heard of with colleagues, around the subject of UFOs, UAP, potentially anomalous experiences? Is that something you've ever been exposed to?
Yes. Inevitably, I have the X-Files sort of picture of the UFO in my office. So I try and destigmatize conversations immediately when you walk in, not least because the children, you know, sort of awe at the spaceship that's on the wall. not as a presentation, but yeah, I've had patients come in and say, oh, do you believe in UFOs? And I say, yeah, you know, I believe in something going on out there. And then they'll start talking about the Senate hearings if it's recent or before it'll be something else. And they'll say, oh, I've had this happen to me, or I had that happen to me. It was really strange. Even doctors, there's a senior doctor friend of mine had an episode happen to him in Thailand while he was having dinner with his wife. And they even went to the police station and said, look, we found that we saw this unusual thing flying around and it shot off at great speed. I won't say his name, of course. In terms of patients, we generally tend not to discuss patient information or through confidentiality. I think Paul's presented his physical findings and physical case previously. And we've even mentioned it in the physical health effects paper from Unhidden. And there are some unusual phenomena that can occur if you look at our physical effects paper that are quite interesting to a physician, and certainly something that we should probably be trained about. If indeed there is an event that happens that's obviously real for the patient and obviously real in real life and not necessarily a psychological abnormality, something to do with mental ill health. Obviously, there are people with mental ill health, which we take seriously and we have to manage it because there is an overlay, unfortunately. It can be hard to tease out, but inevitably there's going to be some real events, UAP or not, which need to be taken seriously. And if there's health effects or psychological effects, we need to take those seriously too.
So just, if I may add, because you both mentioned Paul Sinclair, and he is something of an inspiration too behind Unhidden. Indeed. So his book, Night People, records the incident in 1997 where he saw grey figures around his bed during the nighttime, had these two deep ash-filled puncture wounds in his back. And I heard him talk at a conference in Manchester in summer 2023, and he explained that when he went to Bridlington A&E department, rather than tell the casualty officer the truth, he chose to lie. It was better to be thought to be a liar than to be somebody telling the truth and potentially risk a mental illness diagnosis with all that entailed. And I sat there in the audience and two thoughts occurred to me. First of all, how very wrong that was. We're brought up with the philosophy that doctors are there, that we're supposed to be able to tell them the most intimate secrets about bits of our body that aren't going very well. But there's something about this UFO topic. The stigma is so high that people are prepared to lie to their doctors. And the second thing occurred to me, and obviously you get this in person with Paul, the book's very well written, but you don't get quite the intimacy of it. Watching him present in Manchester, he was moved, he was emotional. And, you know, I don't need forward-looking infrared radar or special sensors to look a fellow human being in the eye and see somebody who's in pain or troubled or talking about difficult experiences. And all I want to do with those people is try and help, try and make things better. And so that's why the central path, the people aspect of UAPs is so important, and Unhidden fills that space. There are people on one side focused on bodies and craft and secrets and tell me what's really going on. There's people on the other side who go, no, it's all a bit more complicated. It's about consciousness and it's about the nature of reality. For us, there's this middle ground. It's about people, it's about conversations, and it's about care. That's where we are.
I was the actual doctor on the voiceovers during that talk, and I remember going through Paul's medical file, and the doctors, the consultants had done histology and they couldn't find any rationale for it. They couldn't find an underlying health condition. And he was spending hours telling me about what he was feeling. And he was, he's an incredibly genuine individual. And it's very hard to not believe, the science, the histology's there, everything's there, the scarring, etc. This is not a made up phenomenon, certainly not in Paul's case. And doctors often can be dismissive if not sort of shown the way that this is a true phenomenon, and they have to understand it, and it's not automatically a psychological condition. So it was a very sort of moving experience helping Paul with that element of his talk, and I think that's where John and I sort of kind of almost touched base, wasn't it?
That's right.
So on that then, let's stay with John for this one, with that interest in psychology. you've both touched on the idea of there are genuine mental health issues. I think most folks would say there is a mental health crisis in the UK. I imagine the United States is something similar. I'd just been speaking to Richard Dolan, and he was talking about the huge numbers of people who are on some kind of antidepressants or medication for conditions. These things aren't being dealt with, or just, you know, they're just being kept at bay as such, and, you know, we're not treating the root causes. But in the UK, there clearly is. There are waiting lists for telephone services months or years long. People have got their children on waiting lists to see various different services that are now stretching into the years because of the amount of folks looking for various services. So when it comes to UFOs, John, how would you toe the line, to use a British phrase, when someone's sharing an experience with you? You have to have, surely, in the back of your mind, is this a true experience, or is there a genuine case for mental health issues surfacing here?
There's a few things to unpack, and it's great to have a doctor in the conversation in case I misspeak. I think we need to draw an important distinction between mental health and well-being, and we're all on some sort of a spectrum there. We have good days and bad days, and things go well and things go less well. We cope and we don't cope to different extents. That's very different to a mental illness, a formal diagnosis of a psychosis, let's say. And there's a French academic, called a French a psychologist academic called Professor Thomas Rebeyron, and he talks about the pathologization of the exceptional experience. And what he means by that is that people who have a strange encounter, something that might be frightening, something that's unusual, but there's nothing wrong with them at all, they've just seen something odd and unusual, they can get pulled into a formal diagnosis of mental illness, that experience is pathologized. And that was the danger that Paul was facing, and his strategy was to lie to avoid that. So in a way, there are three levels of trauma that the experiencer has. The first is they see something frightening in the sky that may be traumatic, may cause alarm, may be a positive experience, some of them are, but that's the first one. The second trauma is when they try and share that with friends and family, and instead of being given compassion and care, oh, you poor chap, you know, do you want to go for a coffee? Do you want to go for a pint? It's like, no, you are a liar, you know, you are shaming our family. Do not say that again. And then the third one is when they try and go and talk to their doctor that they may be drawn into a mental illness diagnosis. It's important to say that a small number of people who report exceptional experiences do have a mental illness. And that's why one of the things we point to in our preparedness plan, which is based a lot on the importance of better conversations, that there needs to be a mental illness triage layer, so that small number of people who do need formal mental illness care from psychologists and psychiatrists receive that. But the vast number of people who see something strange do not need that. And it's nothing different than the sort of trauma you would get if you saw a nasty road traffic accident or perhaps a mugging on the tube. You have shock, you may have depression, maybe some form of PTSD, but it's not a mental illness. And doctor, if I've misspoken on that, do correct me.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a natural response to any event. So if a bereavement, you might have a bereavement reaction. If you have a traumatic event, particularly a significant one, you know, the Japanese people who involved in Fukushima, they may have had PTSD, etc. So these events are real. These events produce an event such as PTSD or an anxiety or depression. You would classify those patients with those conditions. You wouldn't say they were psychotic. Likewise, if someone sees an unusual thing in the sky, who says it's not military? Okay, I saw an orb. It was something. As a doctor, you could say, well, okay, it could have been something it was anomalous, but maybe it was something explainable, but it still left the patient with a mental health issue or some other kind of issue that they then need to resolve and access health services for. So just take it seriously, take it at face value, open. Of course, you have to have your antennae on if there's a psychological event going on, psychosis, etc. And there are Schneider's first rank principles about psychosis, schizophrenia and everything else, you know, thought broadcast, thought insertion, all of these sorts of things. And a doctor is well-trained, a GP is well-trained. They are aware of these sorts of issues that you have to elicit and understand. obviously a patient who has an experience will say a very clear thing. Look, I saw something fly over. The second thing you might then do as a doctor would be maybe triangulate that. Was there something in the newspaper? Were you with someone that saw it? It's unusual that you get folie à deux. There was a film about that with the Joker, wasn't there, recently? But, you know, and I've seen that once before. However, it wasn't to do with UFOs. It was to do with the CIA. But the other thing would be that maybe if it's not folie à deux, then you would be thinking, well, look, there is a triangulation here. So isn't this more of a real phenomenon rather than an unusual phenomenon that I then need to start, you know, talking about, you know, psychological referrals and medicines potentially, or, and et cetera. So that's probably how most GPs would deal with that, hopefully. There are some that might, you know, put people in a basket of something else. But I think that's becoming less frequent as the information about UAPs, et cetera, becomes more evident, you know, with the Senate hearings. Although just going back, I mean, 10 years, I remember being given a foil hat, literally a foil hat made from foil by a colleague because he was joking around. But it was kind of a very real version of stigma that I experienced. But it's a lot better now. And indeed, when you start talking to people, especially if you are a learned individual like myself, who hopefully knows a little bit about it, you know, I can, you know, make a good sort of showing of myself, you know, and you know, give them what for, as it were, when they sort of challenge me about certain things. So it depends on the individual that you're talking to in terms of how they respond as well, I think.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Game night's fun until someone spends 5 minutes lining up one shot. Chalk, breathe, re-chalk, still aiming. While they figure it out, I fire up Chumba Casino. I can spin anywhere, anytime, and there's always a new social casino game every week. Spins happen way faster than that shot. Play now at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Let me give you an example. I've shared this once or twice on the podcast before, and I try and keep it relatively vague, although it was in quite a public setting. In the very, very early days of the podcast, I was recommended a certain gentleman as a guest. And I attended in the early days of COVID. Everything was very much, we were deep in lockdown. Mm-hmm. This was when everything was virtual and it was literally, you could go to the shops, you know, maybe. And I attended an online UFO conference, a local meeting for a different part of England. And the gentleman speaking shared his experiences. He was a relatively well-known experiencer in UK circles. And he started his presentation by talking about the experience started during a traumatic experience involving his father when he was a young child. Mm. I'll just say that much, and it's pretty extreme. Mm. So for me to hear that, I've always got that in the back of my mind. And that's probably, I don't know if that's an unfair bias, but to hear someone, their UFO experiences began during this extremely traumatic childhood event, as a complete layman, I'm thinking, well, that sort of thing could be a coping mechanism, a way to deal with what was happening. And I'm not saying that's clearly the case for every experiencer, but then it just goes to show you don't know what's happened in someone's life, someone's background. And I think you say, you know, your antenna switches on. So it's a very delicate conversation sometimes to have as to what these things are, why they've happened. Maybe they haven't happened, but they're a mask for something else. And I think obviously as part of what Unhidden's trying to do with this report, you know, preparing for disclosure and preparedness, it's got to cover a whole range of, it's got to run the gamut, doesn't it, of all kind of medical issues and whatnot. Let's get into the document then.
I'll just interject. I think in that situation, there is potentially a phenomenon where people who go through some emotional event, there seems to be more sort of contacts, as it were. So I think there's something about that that's going on. And indeed, I tried to look into that previously with a small research project, but unfortunately, there wasn't enough people to give us meaningful data, unfortunately. But that aside, I think doctors have to be compassionate. And whether it was real or not, the patient was suffering. And much like our preparedness plan, it's packaged in such a way as to have patients as a focus at a population level, of course, but it's it's compassionate. It isn't sort of so clinical that it's not done in a way, you know, it's not done in a way that would be negative. It's more of a positive. Yeah.
And the lead in to this interview segment, I played the 1 minute introductory video from yourself, John, from Unhidden, just to introduce what was happening with this report and with this plan. And I like the way you put it across. It was probably typically British, very UK centric, where it wasn't sensational. You even say, if disclosure happens in the coming months, 20 years time, or perhaps not at all, there is still a conversation that should be having. And why was that so important to lead with?
Well, one of the things that Unhidden is not, is we're not a disclosure group. So we're not advocating for disclosure. What do we want? Disclosure, when do we want it? Now. Mm. We're there to support people pre, during, post disclosure, or never. And I think it's important to make the case that governments prepare for all sorts of things, pandemics, industrial accidents, disasters, and the event that actually happens is not necessarily quite what they prepared for. So they prepared for an influenza pandemic, they got a COVID pandemic, and it wasn't quite right, but the societal resilience was stronger. And we contend that what we're proposing here, and we'll come on to some of the detail, is a set of steps that help build societal resilience against unusual, out of the ordinary, we say paradigm shifting events that challenge psychological security. If UAP disclosure doesn't happen, then there are other things, for example, the rise of artificial general intelligence, or who knows what else. And that's important because our key stakeholder group is governments, public governments, health providers, professional bodies, and others, for whom the things we're talking about in this podcast, they wouldn't know one end of a three-letter acronym from another three-letter acronym. And we have to avoid that, so to speak, sort of tissue rejection. And if we can frame what we're doing as more general resilience building, that goes down well. It starts to get us the conversations we need. The organizations we need to build that resilience exist. The challenge is getting in front of them and making this topic something they're comfortable with. And we're back to our old friend stigma, which prevents that.
Yeah, and we've got the precautionary principle in 1992, where at the Rio Declaration they said that if a harm is going to be caused to a human, there should be a response created. And of course, if we had, you know, Operation Cygnus in 2016 and Crimson Contagion 2019, they were the influenza ones. But you can be prepared. I think it was Mike Tyson that said, if you get, you know, everyone's prepared until you get punched in the face, and then it all goes wrong. But yeah, if you're not prepared at all, you know, it's like getting in the ring with him and you're a 12-year-old boy scout. You know, you're going to get destroyed and pummeled. And so in this situation, we are giving a start of a 10 at least for preparedness, you know, so that we're not sort of on the back foot straight away as we kind of were in COVID. I remember sort of doing, you know, 1,000 people on a very much a stream like this, answering and fielding questions that, you know, doing my best as a GP with the limited knowledge that we had. It wasn't prepared. It wasn't, you know, sort of anything. And, you know, you can make mistakes in that regard. So it's always best if you can be prepared, much like a scouts. That's why I said the scouts. This is very much that. It's been prepared by significant senior clinicians who have experience in these sorts of fields, public health clinicians, etc. So it's a serious document and hopefully will be taken as such. We know that the National Security Risk Assessment Team, they're now sort of focusing more on the level of a risk rather than just whether or not it's going to happen. So they're kind of going along with that. We know the Royal Society said that if in 2010, if disclosure were to happen and non-human intelligence was around, there should be a public health response. And it is becoming more mainstream. Even Deloitte in 2026, this year, looked at this as a potential sort of planning event. They used disclosure as the event, although they didn't say that we thought it was going to happen. They used it as an event. So it's becoming a bit more mainstream. So that's sort of interesting. Any big paradigm shifting thing needs to be prepared for, I believe. And this report doesn't just hold true for alien disclosure or something of that nature. It holds true for many forms of disclosure or other event as well. Okay.
What then does a preparedness report look like then? Because you mentioned pandemics, natural disasters, terror attacks. How do you begin to put together a report like this, where you're going to have to use terms like non-human intelligence, you're perhaps going to have to use aliens, craft, NHI? How do you begin to do that and not have your colleagues look at it and laugh at you and throw it back in your face?
We started with research of public health principles, and I'll give you a couple briefly. There's a famous public health practitioner called Jeffrey Rose, and his argument is that if a large number of people are exposed to a small risk, that produces more harm than a small number of people exposed to a large risk. And what comes out of that is that you need to try to reduce the average risk, the average exposure. And that's what we do with vaccination programs. And you also need to be able to deal with the people who are affected at some sort of surge capacity. That was why we needed the Nightingale hospitals. And the second principle is one that the people who are always most affected in disasters and from a public health perspective are those who are most vulnerable. They've got other challenges, maybe existing mental health conditions, poor socioeconomic background. And so public health programs need to be designed with that principle in mind, that we need to go out of our way to care and support the most vulnerable. So those are two public health principles that we can apply to disclosure. And just a little aside, those of our community who go, this is all unnecessary, just rip off the Band-Aid, I can cope, they should bear in mind that the research shows that it's the most vulnerable people who are most affected. So they might be fine, but somebody down their street who's not as fortunate as they are might not be. So let's just bear that in mind. The second thing we did, again, a good public health principle, a good public health technique, is we carried out a health needs assessment. And that's looking at who might need support and in what sort of numbers. And we looked at seven possible risk groups, and we identified four that were likely to be at the highest risk. And those were people with strong associations with the science, technology and engineering world, STEM people, because their worldview is quite rigid and this disclosure challenges that. People with strong religious beliefs. People who are vulnerable or have existing mental health conditions for the reasons I've just explained. And then finally, experiences, because the disclosure might trigger a previous experience, or there might be that level of resentment, which is, okay, so you told me there was nothing to this. You've lied to me for 80 years, that sort of resentment. So those four groups, and we came up with calculations on the basis of population, and the likelihood of a negative response or a need for a psychological involvement, psychological support. And we came up with figures for the number of people who might be affected. Those weren't intended to be actual precise calculations, but it was to show that the number of people affected could run into the millions. And therefore that could outstrip the available mental health capacity. And it's something that the authorities should take seriously. And then what we did in the second half of the report is we came up with a series of measures to try and do those two things, to reduce the impact of disclosure at the time it hits, and to help people who might be most affected. And the fundamental principle behind all of that is to encourage better conversations. So the three legs of the stool for the support are, first of all, self-help, to provide resources that people can use to make them calmer, to make them better able to cope with the uncertainty. Simple things, everyday things like breathing exercises, getting off social media, going and doing something you like, getting away from it all, that sort of thing. So we look after ourselves first and foremost. Secondly, the professional support that's needed for therapists, counselors, psychologists and others who will be new to this topic, to make that resource as focused as possible on the support needed around disclosure and UAP. So continuing professional development in this area at pace when it's needed. And then thirdly, the provision of structured conversations. And we're piloting an unhidden conversations group in Australia at the moment. Structured conversations to listen, to support, to understand the sorts of dynamics of ontological shock, of course, are different than the response to a sort of a physical trauma, and to try and design the mechanism for rolling that out at scale. the greatest group there is for conversations in volume that we've come across is Alcoholics Anonymous, who at any one time are supporting around a million people in this structured conversation group that they have. What's needed for UAP disclosure is clearly very different to that, but the number of people who are affected could run into the millions or the tens of millions. So we potentially need conversation groups at that sort of scale, and we're piloting that, and we'll put together the methodology for how that can be done safely and efficiently and with the volume needed. So that's the way we went about it. Long answer, there's a lot in the report, and I would guide people to our website, www.unhidden.org, to go and take a look for themselves at all of the documents I've mentioned.
Martin, let me ask you, with such a profound shift, we're going to go with the assumption disclosure has happened, and I'm going to ask you some questions based off the back of this, those immediate minutes, hours and days afterwards, okay, because it's often discussed. But I think having people with your expertise on here to actually give some light on this would be interesting. We're talking about the medical professions, psychologists, therapists, clinicians, doctors, all needing to be prepared. Is there a risk that this is such a shock to the system? It's not a pandemic, it's not an illness, it's not a flu, that they themselves would struggle with this? And how do you then prepare for psychologists and therapists and clinicians and doctors to need support themselves when they can't support the general public?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good question. I mean, if you look at the work of Kunz, the analysis that he showed is that when a paradigm shifting thing happens or something significant happens, it's never a smooth transition. And obviously the speed with which this happens, definitely not going to be smooth. And obviously there are varying degrees about how people respond to something. So Calhoun in 2004 looked at that, the varying degrees of response. It's going to depend on the individuals themselves. What this plan is designed to do is to, prior to disclosure happening, set up the scenario where stigma can be reduced. People can have conversations about the potential event from happening so that you can then reduce the level of chaos which may occur when something like this might happen. Because, yes, scientists are high up on our list, 20% of the sort of, we have some sort of figures. I won't mention the figures. You should look them up, obviously, because it's quite large numbers of people possibly being affected. And we figure that approximately 10 to 30% of the overall population that we consider might be at risk of this thing called ontological shock, which we haven't really discussed yet, are at risk of requiring some sort of input. And if of course, there's the clinicians are the ones that are at risk as well, I mean, how are they going to provide the input? So we have a response to that with advice, understanding, and knowledge for the clinicians even prior to this event. And obviously, that's one of the reasons why we want to get this taken up, so that we are prepared. Unfortunately, that does require reduction of stigma. It requires introduction of high-level teams, potential training for them, maybe with an online resource, an online one-hour module, you know, the type of treatment that people may get. If it's for high-risk individuals, it may be very similar to what they already provide, but with an understanding about the nature of UAP and the understanding about how they may need to sort of respond to them and talk to them. We have this lower-level scale where we hopefully we'll have sort of general self-help measures that you can do yourself. And hopefully we'll give the clinicians tools with which to respond. Because often if you don't have the tools to respond, you're kind of just floundering away and sort of treading water and just reverting back to sort of first principles. How do I respond to a mental health condition? How do I respond to anxiety? How do I respond to these things? And that might not be the right answer. Two, we need to have clinicians or people who give the right information. And we know that in some of the papers from MIT that if information comes out that is potentially incorrect or correct, it is usually the incorrect information that travels deeper and wider. So obviously, if there is misinformation coming along, then there's going to have to be some learning about communication from the clinician about how to address that poor communication. Where do they get their communication and true information from as well? You know, is it just off the hoof? Is it from the news where some of the stuff was coming for previous pandemics? I won't say the name. you know, it's going to be a significant thing, which is why we say preparedness is key. But we need the high level teams, the you know, the Royal Colleges to accept that this might be something that might happen. And yes, it may be low, likelihood, but it's high impact. And so potentially this is something that we can look at as a clinical group that can respond clinically and not just dismissively. So yeah, I agree with all of that. It's absolutely a risk, which is why we have to do something about it.
And on that, I agree with John's point he made before about it's easy for folks to sit there and say that they agree that they would be absolutely fine with this information, that it wouldn't affect them. And I think there's a lot of folks in the UFO or UAP community who would, they don't know how they would react. And it's, I include myself in that. I would love to sit here and say I would be live streaming disclosure. I'd love to sit here and say that I'd be going, oh, wow, look at this. Trump's got the greys on the White House lawn just now. Make sure you like and subscribe, folks. Comment below. This is fascinating stuff. I might be terrified. I likely would be terrified. I don't know how I would react. And I think it's one of those situations until I'm there.
Hey guys, it's Ryan. I want to tell you about my new pastime, Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has been around for over a decade, delivering the most fun you can have online. Play social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
I don't really know, and it's probably the same for a lot of us. So I'm definitely with John when he makes that point.
Andy, in Ed Specker's work, we have this, cite this in the paper. When there is a fundamental challenge to your world paradigm, particularly if that is very, maybe even physically challenging, Ed Specker indicates that people will have an automatic defensive posture, and it will re-emphasize potentially their worldview, which may be completely the wrong worldview with a new paradigm shift like this. So even more, it is important that we cover this in that regard as well. And we do it with language that is not iatrogenically harmful. So we talk about this shock term. Obviously, that's where we challenge our worldview. If we compound that with our language as doctors, you can say, oh, well, you know, I liken it to, you know, a doctor saying, oh, you've got cancer of your bowel and you're going to die and this is that, versus the way that we're taught, which is, you know, to gently broach the subject, warning shots, etc. And then, you know, it is obviously something that we can deal with. It's manageable. There's a positive here. You know, there is a very similar theme here when talking about European disclosure and the communication mechanisms that you would need to do, particularly if the governments who've been potentially hiding it are mistrusted or distrusted. You know, Who is our sort of voice then that we can believe if it's not government? You know, NASA or SETI are going to be involved with the response. Okay, is that going to be very scientific? Is it just going to be about, well, if it's a signal, where did the signal come from? How strong was it? You know, people are going to be saying, well, who sent it? What type of thing was it? Is it going to try and harm me? You know, these sorts of issues may come up in their minds. And how will you respond as a psychiatrist or a psychologist or a doctor or a GP or just a friend that they're asking about? How are you going to deal with it? And our response has some elements for each and every level, you know, person to person, person to psychologist, person to psychiatrist, and then potentially, obviously, at the public health level, trying to deal with things as well. It's not that we haven't worked it all through. There are some elements of research that we still need to perhaps do. Obviously, the engagement process, possibly even a scenario, much like Cygnus or Crimson Contagion, where we can challenge ourselves as individual scientists and networks to really address what the gaps might be. Because it's always cheaper and easier to deal with gaps prior to they occurring versus when you're in the thick of it and everyone's scrambling for, I don't know, ventilators from God knows where, you know. Yeah. So let's be scientific and have our hats on of preparedness and response and doing it in an efficient, serious way.
Let me ask you this, John. I imagine this would be more from a public perspective, but I imagine if you go on to any news platform, Sky News, BBC, GB News, whoever it may be, and you try and talk about this, some folks might, if you get past the eye rolls and the stigma, say that talking about public health and disclosure might make the topic sound dangerous, more so than it needs to be. What would you say to that as a response?
Well, I work in the construction sector, and we plan for earthquakes by making buildings seismically qualified. Doing that is not frightening. Preparedness done in the right way is reassuring. And the same argument applies to disclosure. I'm reassured that governments plan for pandemics and other things. I would be more reassured if they do. And so we're not promoting fear. We're promoting the potential for care and the reduction of harm, which I don't think is argued as a bad thing or can be. What we do find, so in terms of what we've been talking about, and Unhidden's role is not to do all of this. There are public health and other health organisations, disaster management contingency planning organisations in the UK. We have the UK Health Security Agency, the Department for Health. In the US, they have FEMA, they have Health and Human Services and NIH. Those are the organisations who have the mechanisms and the skill to do this. We are the convener and the advocate of the importance of this. And you talk about going on Sky News. Well, I wish, because back to our old friend stigma, this is not something that they regard as serious. And I wonder whether Disclosure Day will be a helpful thing or a less helpful thing. You know, what we're talking about here is what happens next in a Disclosure Day type scenario. You know, no spoilers here, but your listeners will kind of get the idea that there's some sort of disclosure and it happens on a day, so it's quite sudden. What happens next? Does everybody go back to their normal lives, or are there months and years of depression and anxiety and PTSD and societal disruption? In their book, AD After Disclosure, really interesting 2012 book, pre-smartphones largely, so information would go down around much more quickly. I'm talking Bryce Sable and Richard M. Dolan's book. Yeah. They say, they give examples of why society breaks down. Between 10 and 30% in their estimate of people will be adversely affected. And it may not be you, but your life might be very difficult because the lady or man who looks after your daughter in the nursery is affected and can't go and carry out those duties. The man who drives the truck delivering your mother's insulin to the pharmacy can't drive the truck. And the team who fix the power plant when it breaks down can't go and fix it. So it only takes a few people in relatively important roles and societal resilience breaks down. So we need to be vigilant and we need to have a plan. And that's not scary. That's good practice and common sense.
And Martin, you were talking before about the importance of getting organisations involved, preparedness, making sure clinicians are prepared, therapists, psychologists. It seems to me there's almost quite a big bridge to be built there for that gap of knowledge, perhaps even will versus skill, something I've learned about in my professional life, where you could go now to a whole bunch of colleagues, I'm sure, and go, okay, here's this wonderful report. You're speaking about it in an incredibly sensible way, like you both have. And I'm sure many people listening to this have appreciated or watching this have appreciated, but actually getting them to pick it up, read it, accept it, and then act on it, those all seem like very big tasks. How do you begin to bridge that gap and get folks to go, do you know what? Okay, let's at least entertain the idea just in case.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an element here. It starts with the stigma. It always goes back to that stigma issue, because obviously, if you're a scientist, you may not engage with something that you believe to be completely, you know, fooey, as it were. So I think you talked about sort of going on to CNN or Sky News, whatever it might be. It depends if that is going to happen more often. We know that the Senate hearings are happening. They are serious individuals. People are taking notice. Hopefully that's destigmatizing things going on in America. We don't really have something like that here in the UK. I think there has been on talk radio some UFO discussions, certainly when there were the balls flying around I think it was New Jersey and all of that. There was some discussion.
The drones,
with Alex.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was with Alex Phillips. And she handled that really, really well. I thought she was an excellent sort of host there. She took it seriously. And it just needs a little bit more of that at a cultural level. And I see the change already. I mean, 10 years ago, I got the foil hat. Now I'm getting a sort of a discussion. People even coming up to me and asking, oh, what do you think of this, Martin? You know about about this, and I'll give a response and an answer. So it's becoming a bit more, well, certainly less stigmatizing, and a little bit more curiosity is developing. And I think there's an element about curiosity here where clinicians need to be challenged to say, well, look, you know, maybe they're not traveling here with our known conventional science or whatever, if that's what's happening, but perhaps you need to be prepared. You need to be ready. You don't always see a heart attack every day in the street, but you know what? You need to be ready. You're a doctor. So perhaps maybe you have to have a similar ethos with some, again, high risk, low likelihood. No one thought that there was going to be a COVID pandemic, but they sure as hell think about it now, and they have to be responsible and respond accordingly. I would say the same would apply to UOP disclosure, that people have to be responsible and understand that. And again, if we can get the Royal Colleges to accept it and make it one of these modules that you can learn, then I think that's going to be something that people are going to accept more readily.
And John, what would you say to someone now then who's listening to this, who feels frightened, isolated, or worried about speaking about their experiences? And I ask because so often I'm asking this to folks from the United States and their perspective. So having some folks on from the UK, if you had people getting in touch with yourself and your organisation, what would you say to them?
Well, we do have people getting in touch. We're a small organisation. We're not able to consult or refer, but it's always very interesting to talk to people who've had experiences. I see it as a real gift when people share what they've seen with me. And we ask experiences, what are they looking for? How can Unhidden help? And they say things like, well, first of all, I want to know what I saw. And I say, well, I can't really help you with that. Sorry, I don't know what you saw. But they say, what I want then is validation. What they mean by that is they want to be treated seriously. They want to be listened to. They want their testimony to be respected. And I see it as a little bit similar. You know, if you had a colleague at work, they said, oh, I've just come back from holiday. I saw a really unusual butterfly. You wouldn't go, I don't believe you. There are no such things as unusual butterflies. No, you would say, that's really interesting. What made it unusual? Why is that special to you? You know, tell me more about it. You'd ask those sorts of questions. You'd have the conversation. So that's the sort of thing that experiencers are looking for. And in terms of having the better conversations that we might want to have about UAPs, the first thing to say is, well, the number one surefire way not to have a good conversation around UAPs is not to try. And that's a good bit of advice about anything you're trying to do. Secondly, choose your timing well. You know, don't talk to somebody when they're just about to go to sleep or just about to go into a really important job interview. After a nice meal is always a good thing. And choose your opening gambit carefully. You know, don't say, hey, Dad, do you believe in UFOs? I did that once. That didn't go down so well. But you could talk about, have you seen that President Trump has started releasing the UFO files? Did you know that a major barrister, Jonathan Kaplan, King's Counsel, has just written a book on UFOs? What do you make about that? There's all sorts of conversational starters. And I would really encourage your listeners to try and have a conversation. What's the worst thing that can happen? The worst thing is that conversation gets closed down or doesn't go there. And little by little, if we all have those conversations, we push back together on stigma and we make it more acceptable, which the overarching thing that Martin's mentioned a few times is for this preparedness plan to work, we need to dial down stigma. And that's all about having more and better conversations.
And Martin, what would success look like then coming from this plan? Is that something you've got a timeline for, weeks, months, years, or is it action off the back of it? What does that look like?
Well, the problem with timelines is we don't know if and when it might happen. So ideally start as soon as possible. We write down what are our sort of general outcomes, and John can help me with this, but essentially, convening a meeting with high level sort of Royal Colleges or led by one, where people can come and discuss the sort of topic, learn the language, because the language for some people is going to be completely foreign. When I sort of doing some commissioning work and I spoke to a colleague GP, he said, I don't even understand your language, Martin. I don't understand. And the same, I think the same for this sort of language. People don't understand what UAP is in some cases. And certainly disclosure will be a completely new phenomenon. So we need a to convene a meeting, potentially this Cygnus-like event. You know, once that's happened, the meeting, we kind of move on to a kind of a practice, as it were, even to make it fun, as a fun thing. I think it's just generally getting some acceptance. I mean, even ontological shock isn't really coined as a DSM term, DSM being that dictionary of mental health conditions. We don't have that, and it may very well not need to be that. But at least taking it on by the Royal College of Psychiatrists, for example, just to even discuss this phenomenon of paradigm shifting information can cause some kind of psychological harm, and we call it, or rather late, I think it was Lang that in 1960 called it ontological shock. Actually, he's a psychologist. That aside, that kind of acceptance, we just need more acceptance, maybe some research about what that might mean. How do we measure ontological shock? I mean, we give a response about out of 9, this is how much shock someone might have, the physical or the psychological, and we kind of do our health needs assessment on that. But what is the actual, have we done some research upon that? How would we understand how our responses are achieving some improvement? The harm is there. We provide a response, a treatment. How do we know that that's improving things? How do we not? We're sort of a little bit in the dark, but we're also knowledgeable, and we're trying to get people together so that we can have even more brains in the room. We've got significant brains in the room already, but we need more, and ones that accept the actual phenomenon, accept the potential, so that we can then move forward. So I think that would be, over the next sort of 6 months, if we could get something like that happening, even a conference just to convene where people are willing to discuss it, then that will be a good outcome for me. But John, any other thoughts?
Yeah, I think conference is the thing. We have plans for a conference in the States. That's where the action on this largely is, probably in early 2027, convened through and with a US university. And we think that will be easier for the sorts of public health, contingency planning, disaster management people to engage with. Not that they're engaging directly with Unhidden, but they're engaging under the auspices of a university. And the key phrase in the back of the plan is building the coalition. We can't do everything, but we can convene. We need the organizations who have the mechanisms to build the preparedness planning and deal with the surge support as and when it's needed. We need to get them on the pitch, and we need that to happen quickly.
And just before you both go, in the last couple of days, we've had an announcement, and I'm still getting across it myself, but there's going to be a board, a group in the United States made up of different disciplines looking at the UAP topic, and the scientific advisory side of it has been is going to be head up by Avi Loeb. He has appointed multiple different members, including Gary Nolan, Peter Skafish, Matthew Shigadis, Michael Shermer, who is one of the more controversial names, a very well-known skeptic. I believe you also are aware of a couple of folks on there too, and their particular positions. So I would just love your quick thoughts, gentlemen. Start with you, John, on this board, the setup of it, and what you think may come of it.
Well, it's encouraging to see that Avi's appointed two psychologists to the board, Dr. Janice Vilhauer, who's putting a paper together for the Disclosure Foundation event in on the 25th of June in Washington around the psychological impact of UAPs. So she's a very good choice. There's also a Dr. Omar Eldadi, who has been working with the Galileo Project for several years. He's a PhD in psychology. So that's very positive. I think, and Martin might nod at this, we might like to see a medical doctor involved as well, and it'd be interesting to see how the science advisory group links with other groups and how it all fits together. It's all a bit hard to work out what fits into what and how decisions are being taken. So a bit more transparency, and the UAP Disclosure Act and the UAP Records Review Board, that was very clear and very transparent, and maybe some of that transparency will come.
Yeah, yourself, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great positive. We need an external group, potentially from governments, that people can believe, particularly if there's that phenomenon about the governments not being believed. I think the UK should have their own unit, a SAGE-like team that we had in COVID. because it doesn't always translate what goes on in America comes here. We're culturally different, economically different. We have different setups. Our health systems are different. So I think we almost certainly have to have a British version as well. So I look forward to being on that board if someone asks me. But certainly it's in our paper. We do cite that we would want such a thing to happen. So it's just another one of the exemplars of our preparedness plan response. I suggest people go and have a look at it. It's a really excellent read. Lots of citations, lots of science behind it. A serious number of individuals wrote it. It's a serious paper. I strongly suggest you read it.
I'll make sure all those links are in the description, gentlemen. Thank you so much for your time and joining me on the podcast. Best of luck. Look forward to future updates. And for me, do you know what? Maybe it's time the Brits do get a bit more involved in a public way on this. I get so many comments from you folks over in the States who listen going, you're leaving it all up to us. And yes, the US leads the way on this topic. For good or for bad, it does seem to be where all the action is. But maybe it's time for the UK to get more involved and unhidden, certainly. Looks like it's starting that off in a big way. So thank you for your work, and I look forward to hearing what comes next.
Thank you indeed.
And thank you, Andy. Thanks for having
the audience as well. Thank you.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
By law, 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.